What's up, America? This is DJ Liberty here on the one and only Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. Hope you guys are having a great Monday. Great start of the week. I know I am. Sucks to be going back to classes, but, you know, whatever. We're back here on Penguin Radio, and I got a great show for you guys today. Some international political news, some national news, and some state news having to do with California. So let's get it started right here on Political Row with your host, DJ Liberty. So, the Malaysia Flight 370 has actually caused a little bit of a stir-up of where it could be found. New signal sounds, just like one from a plane's beacon, have come up on radar. Now that an Australian naval ship towing U.S. equipment has detected underwater pulses, a top search official says the pings are the most promising lead so far in the hunt for Flight 370. Investigators hope the signals could be locator beacons from the plane's data recorders, but they're really not sure yet. So it's kind of back and forth. They're not sure if these are really beacons that are coming from a cockpit of this Malaysia Flight 370, but the beacons are giving off a sound that would sound like something that comes from a cockpit. It's too soon to say whether the sounds were signals from the missing plane. However, authorities appeared optimistic as they described the find on Monday. We've got a visual indication on a screen, and we've also got an audible signal. And the audible signal sounds to me just like an emergency locator beacon, said retired Air Chief Marshal Angus Houston, the chief of the Australian agency coordinating the search. We are encouraged that we are very close to where we need to be. He also, though, cautioned reporters to the threat of this information to take it cautiously and responsibly until it's actually proven that this could be the actual plane underwater somewhere in some kind of shape or form that can give off an emergency beacon. It could take days before officials determine whether the signals came from the plane, which fell off radar on March 8th from Malaysia flying to Beijing. Search teams have been scanning vast swaths of the Indian Ocean in search for the aircraft, but there's been very little signals of to where the plane could even be in a general direction in the Indian Ocean because it just fell off the map, just gone, and it has been untraceable until this promising fact that there are some beacons out there. We don't know whether it is to this aircraft or not. Finding pings from the data recorders would be a major step in the investigation, helping searchers narrow the area where they're looking. Authorities reduced the size of the search area on Tuesday, focusing on a smaller area about a third of the size of the previous search zone. It's come down to 30,000 square miles, about 1,400 miles northwest of Perth. Australian officials are scheduled to give an update on the screen's progress at 11 a.m. Tuesday. For investigators trying to hear the signals, time is running out. The batteries powering the beacons, which are designed to start sending signals when a plane crashes into water, last about 30 days after the devices are activated. Monday marks the 31st day in the hunt for the plane. Experts have said it's possible that the batteries could last several days longer if they were at full strength. That race against the clock is the number one challenge searchers face, U.S. Navy Commander William Marks told CNN on Monday. The developments over the weekend were encouraging, he said, but it's almost a day and a half since then. This is a 24-hour operation. We haven't quit since we initially heard these signals, he said. We've been going continuously around the clock, and we haven't been able to reacquire them. Searchers are still scouring the waters, but their optimism is more cautious now, he said. As hours pass, our optimism is fading away ever so slightly. Now, the signal has not come back since it first did. It was around for a couple hours and then was gone, or it was around for more than 2 hours, and then a second detection lasted for about 13 minutes. The signals detected about 1,750 kilometers northwest of Perth, Australia, were consistent with those sent by a flight data recorder and a cockpit voice recorder. Though these signals heard in the seawater could be scattered anywhere in the water within about a 4,500 meter radius, and it could be almost like 14,800 feet deep. It's a tough search. I mean, the beacons are some sort of a promising fact that there could be something out there, but it's not promising it could be the plane, and if it is, it's just literally running on its last legs of batteries. So now we're going to switch over to more Russia and Ukraine news, as the White House has warned Russia to not intervene in eastern Ukraine. Secretary of State John Kerry agreed Monday to meet with top diplomats from Russia, Ukraine, and the European Union in a new push to calm tensions in eastern Ukraine, as the White House threatened to further sanctions if Moscow intervenes. Kerry's meeting with his counterparts will take place in the next 10 days, the State Department said, and comes amid mounting U.S. concerns that Russia could build on its recent annexation of Crimea by trying to split off other areas of Ukraine. To that end, the White House issued a warning to Russian President Vladimir Putin. If Russia moves into eastern Ukraine, either overtly or covertly, this would be a very serious escalation, White House spokesman Jay Carney said, adding that the U.S. is prepared to impose further sanctions on sectors of the Russian economy should the situation escalate. Now, pro-Russian activists who have barricaded inside a government building in eastern Ukraine proclaimed the region independent while calling for a referendum on the ceding from Ukraine, a chain of events with ominous echoes of the prelude to Russia's annexation last month of Crimea. The Ukrainian government has vowed to quell the unrest despite the tens of thousands of Russian troops stationed along their joint border, making clear the U.S. considers Russia responsible for inciting unrest in eastern Ukraine. Carney said that there's strong evidence that some pro-Russian protesters who have taken over government buildings in eastern Ukraine were paid and are not local residents. What's clear is that this is a result of increased Russian pressure on Ukraine, and we see it in the troops that have massed on the border, Carney said, urging Putin to remove those troops from the border. To those advocating a tougher U.S. response, the White House has added to Moscow that they're against insufficient actions towards Ukraine, and Senator John McCain, the Republican from Arizona, said the unrest in eastern Ukraine appeared to come straight out of President Putin's playbook. As the risk of further Russian aggression against Ukraine appears to be growing, it is outrageous that the Obama administration still has not met the Ukrainian government's request for modest military assistance. The White House has resisted calls to send advanced weaponry to Ukraine, arguing that the goal is to de-escalate the situation rather than inflame it. In a phone call earlier Monday, Kerry told his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, that the U.S. was watching events in an array of eastern Ukrainian cities with great concern and skepticism that they were spontaneous, the State Department said. Kerry pointed out that the Russian intelligence operatives working in Ukraine had recently been arrested and called on Russia's government to disavow the actions of separatists. Lavrov, for his part, emphasized a persistent need for a deep and transparent constitutional reform with full involvement of all political forces and regions, particularly amid the escalating protests in southern Ukraine, Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement. He also underlined the importance of a real dialogue on the federative structure of Ukraine and sealing its bloc-free status. Now, this is becoming another huge problem because after taking Crimea, Russia has moved into eastern Ukraine and is taking over government buildings and trying to annex that away from everything else in Ukraine and trying to cut it off from the rest of the world and just literally trying to take Ukraine one piece at a time. Now, you saw that Senator McCain is a little bit frustrated with the involvements that Obama and his administration have taken and feels that there needs to be advanced weaponry in Ukraine. However, the White House feels that the situation needs to de-escalate and not escalate. And they feel that if sending advanced weaponry to Ukraine, the situation could escalate and it could start another who knows, a World War III. I mean, that's been thrown out there so many times around with me and my friends. I mean, not necessarily do I agree with it, and it's a big jump to something like that. But, I mean, if you think about it, what else could possibly go on here? If we send weapons into Ukraine, it'll look like straight off the bat we are trying to go against Russia with weapons as, you know, an attack of war. It'd kind of be like an indirect signal that we want war with Russia. Now, Ukraine has said it retakes buildings that have been seized by protesters. However, as I stated earlier, there have been pro-Russian activists and everything that have taken over buildings in Ukraine. Ukrainian special forces moved against pro-Russian demonstrators in the eastern city of Donetsk late Monday after the country's acting president vowed to resist efforts to dismember his country, his office reported. The troops cleared protesters from the headquarters of Ukrainian security services in Donetsk, one of the three cities where pro-Moscow uprisings took place over the weekend. Acting President Oleksandr Turchynov's office announced Monday night. There were no casualties in the operation, Victoria Sumar, Deputy Secretary of the National Defense and Security Council, told reporters. Police battled protesters in one of the other two cities, while the authorities set up a committee to negotiate with self-declared army in the third. The reports came several hours after the president blamed separatist groups coordinated by Russian special services for the revolts, which he said echoed events leading to the Russian annexation of Crimea 3 weeks ago. Pro-Moscow protesters seized government buildings, raised Russian flags, and declared new governments in Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkov on Sunday. Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said the goal of the protesters was to destabilize Ukraine, allowing foreign troops to cross the border and seize the territory of the country. Russia, which has an estimated tens of thousands of troops near the Ukrainian border, said it was watching closely and told Ukraine to quit blaming it for Ukrainian problems. President Vladimir Putin's government pushed Ukraine to set up a federal system in which regions with ethnic Russian majorities would have more autonomy, and its foreign ministry urged Ukraine to enter into talks over the issue. Now, Russia here is defending their side, saying that they have tried to help Ukraine, and since Ukraine isn't doing what they ask, they feel they need to intervene to make that happen. They feel that the only way Russia can be successful is if they intervene and act as though their government is part of Ukraine's, and Russia feels that this is the way to get it all done. Ignore foreign policy, ignore the European Union, ignore the entire world, and do what they want to do. However, I mean, to be honest, it's not just the U.S. that's in this battle against Russia being in Ukraine. It's the entire world. And that's what also raises questions about another world war, is because everybody is against what Russia is doing. I mean, it's completely wrong to be going into a country like Ukraine and, you know, basically just slowly taking it over piece by piece. It's just so wrong. And in Washington, officials urged Russian President Vladimir Putin's government to disavow the protests and warned further Russian intervention in Ukraine because it would bring stiffer economic sanctions than those already imposed over the Crimean annexation. So here the White House is stressing that if anything more happens in eastern Ukraine, there will be even tougher sanctions imposed on Russian administrators and officials. Now, in other news, this kind of shifts gears a little bit, but Spain has arrested four people accused of attempting to export equipment to Iran. An Iranian and three Spaniards who secretly tried to export to Iran industrial equipment that could not be used to make that could be used to make missiles part of enriched uranium have been arrested in Spain. The European Union and the United States banned the exports to Iran of certain dual-use machinery and technology that could be used to aid Iran's military program. The four suspects were arrested on April 1st. The Iranian man, 47 years old, was detained in Palma de Mallorca on Spain's Balearic Islands, and a judge remanded him to prison April 3rd on suspicion of contraband in dual-use material belonging to a criminal organization and money laundering, said a civil guard captain with the intelligence division. The three Spaniards are from the same family. The father, in his 70s, and a son, in his 40s, were arrested in Tarragona in eastern Spain. A daughter, in her 40s, was also arrested in nearby Barcelona. They face the same preliminary charges, but the judge released them on the condition that they do not leave Spain and report regularly to authorities. Now, that kind of gets them off the hook a little bit. I mean, they're released, and all they have to do is report regularly to authorities. The charges carry potential prison terms of about 10 years. The investigation began last year when the Civil Guard detected that two metal-forming dual-use industrial machines had been illegally imported into Spain. The three Spanish suspects were administrators of the import firm. Now, authorities later demanded that the machines had been acquired from a company that works in the defense sector in the United Kingdom and had been brought to Spain with the aim of waiting for an opportune time to secretly send them to Iran. Now, violating international sanctions against Iran for the development of its nuclear and missile programs. Authorities seized two metal-forming industrial machines, which could be used to make missile casings or equipment to aid in the enrichment of uranium. The Civil Guard also seized abundant documentation about exports and the sale of defense and double-use equipment, as well as a large amount of computer data that is being studied. In January 2013, national police arrested two people in northern Spain and seized a trailer truck carrying 44 valves made of nickel and chromium alloy that were intended for export to be used for Iran's nuclear program. Now, this is kind of shocking and scary to the rest of the world, especially the United States, with everything that's been going on with us and Iran and basically the entire world in Iran. I mean, obviously, nobody wants them to have a nuclear power program. And it looks like there are a lot of people in Spain or people traveling through Spain that are getting caught trying to make this happen. This is kind of a scary aspect because if Spain can't catch these people like they've done here, I mean, what if one slips up and it gets through? I mean, we don't even know. Maybe it has, and maybe Iran already has a nuclear program and we don't even know about it. Now, that is going to end the first segment here on Political Row. We will return with a couple more stories for international news, and then we'll carry on to some national political news, and then after that segment we'll do some California state political news. So stay tuned here on Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. You're with DJ Liberty, the truth and reality. It's your Liberty on the one and only Political Row. Stay tuned.
Thank you. shining, birds are winging, no rain is falling from a heavy sky. What do you want me to do for you, to see you through? For this is all a dream we dream, one afternoon long ago. Walk out of any doorway, feel your way like the day before.
What's up, America? This is DJ Liberty back here on my show, Political Row, on Penguin Radio. Now we are going to get right back into some international political news, and then we'll jump straight into our national political news. To kick it off here on this second segment, the U.S. is going to send two more missile defense ships to Japan to protect them from North Korea. The United States will send these two defense ships, as Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said on Sunday, as a part of an effort to bolster protection from North Korean missile threats. North Korea has carried out a series of missile launches in recent weeks and has warned it was preparing to test another nuclear device, prompting fresh criticism from the U.S. Speaking during a visit to Tokyo, Hagel announced that two Navy destroyers equipped with missile defense systems would be deployed to Japan by 2017. A key focus for our talks today was that the threat was posed by North Korea, Hagel told reporters after he met with Japan's defense and foreign ministers. The announcement followed other steps taken by the Pentagon to bolster its military posture in Japan, including an October decision to establish a second missile defense radar site in Kyoto Prefecture. Hagel also addressed territorial disputes between China and its neighbors. Now, relations between China and Japan are under strain over a territorial row involving a set of small, uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, which has led to frequent tense encounters between the two sides, ships and planes, in recent times. Great powers have great responsibilities, and China is a great power, Hagel said. And with this power comes new and wider responsibilities as to how to use that power. How do you employ that military power? And I'd want to talk with the Chinese about all of that, particularly transparency. The more transparent and the open governments can be with each other, the better for everyone. That avoids miscalculation, misinterpretation, misunderstanding, and hopefully that lowers the risk of conflict. Hagel, which I'll discuss here next, is leaving for Beijing today on Monday. He is going to Beijing and he is going to tour China's new aircraft carrier. Chuck Hagel is expected to get a rare tour Monday of China's first aircraft carrier, becoming the first foreign visitor to go aboard the ship. A senior defense official said Hagel requested the visit, which comes a day after he told reporters that China must better respect its neighbors, a pointed allusion to Beijing's ongoing territorial dispute with Japan and others over remote islands in the East China Sea. He also has continued to urge Beijing to be more transparent about its expanding military. China spent a decade refurbishing the derelict Soviet-era carrier bought from the Ukraine before commissioning it as the Liaoning in 2012. It moved to Qingdao in February 2013 and is part of a major expansion of the Chinese Navy that includes sophisticated new surface ships and even submarines. Early this year, Liaoning completed sea trials in the South China Sea. The official of the news agency said that the carrier tested its combat system, conducted a formation practice, and attained the anticipated objectives. On December 5, early in its trial run, one of the Chinese ships accompanying it was involved in a near collision with a U.S. Navy cruiser, the USS Cowpens, when it was operating in international waters in the South China Sea. U.S. Navy officials said the Cowpens maneuvered to avoid the collision, but it marked the two nations' most serious sea confrontation in years. At the time, a Chinese media report said the U.S. ship got too close to the Liaoning. Hagel is on a 10-day trip to the Asia-Pacific region and was leaving Japan Monday to travel to China, and he is scheduled to meet with senior Chinese leaders before traveling to Mongolia, then returning home. Now, this is hopeful to see that, you know, China, despite everything that's going on, is allowing one of our officials, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, to board their first ever aircraft carrier. Now, even though that, I mean, you know, it's not a big deal like an aircraft carrier, you know, the United States Navy has had that for a while. It's a big deal for China. It's their first one, and he's going to be the first foreign official to ever board it. Now, in other news, for our last topic here on international political news, it has made some surprises for those on Capitol Hill as U.S. is tied to a Cuban Twitter, interestingly enough. The head of a U.S. government agency is scheduled to testify at a congressional hearing Tuesday about a secret Twitter-like communications network that the agency set up in Cuba. The Associated Press reports the network was designed to spark a political uprising in the communist nation. Cuba called this part of a subversive plan to destabilize the country, but the U.S. State Department said that this was just a development program to help the Cuban people. Either way, hidden social network allowed thousands of Cubans to evade government censors. The revelation that the U.S. created a social network hidden from the Cuban government took the U.S. senator who oversees foreign operations funding by surprise. Senator Patrick Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, said, "If I had known, I would have said, 'Are you out of your mind?'" The program was called Zunio, and it functioned like a bare-bones Twitter, allowing users in Cuba to exchange information by text message. At its peak, around 40,000 Cubans used it. They didn't know that it was run by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, normally a humanitarian organization. It paid contractors to collect Cubans' personal cell phone data and send them text messages. Those texts were meant to inspire dissent that would ultimately bring down the Castro government, according to documents obtained by the AP. The State Department claimed the content was innocent, solely weather and sports updates. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mary Harf said, "We did not supply political content. We did not drive the political content. Our sole purpose here was to open the space so they could supply their own political content or talk about anything else they wanted." Funding for the program, just more than $1 million, was routed through overseas bank accounts and front companies in order to keep it under the radar. This is kind of frightening to see that people are kind of using money and funding things under the radar. I mean, you know that this happens all the time in Washington, but It's scary to see that they're using it on something in Cuba, such as like a hidden Twitter like this. And who knows what else could be used under, you know, the hidden radar of what else is going on, what else is being used, what else the public doesn't know about, what else people on Capitol Hill don't know about. So, I mean, it's a little frightening to U.S. citizens, but hopefully everybody can get a handle on it. Hopefully Washington can get a handle on it, and hopefully things don't keep happening like this where things are under the table, kept away from everyone. So with that, that'll conclude the international political news, and we'll jump straight into some national political news. First off, for a little bit of a funny subject, I think, as the White House has been talking with Samsung about the Obama Ortiz selfie. Now, Samsung's reported selfie marketing stunt last week got the company into a bit of trouble with the White House. Senior advisor Dan Pfeiffer said on CBS's Face the Nation that the White House counsel's office has had conversations with Samsung after Boston Red Sox star David Ortiz took a picture of himself and President Barack Obama during a visit to the White House by the 2013 World Series winners. Yeah, baby, go Red Sox, World Series winners. Now, Ortiz, who has an endorsement deal with the company, tweeted out the picture, and Samsung retweeted the post to its 5.2 million followers. Pfeiffer said Obama knew nothing about Ortiz's connection to the company. In general, whenever someone tries to use the president's likeness to promote a product, that's a problem. Ortiz said the selfie wasn't a premeditated marketing ploy, and the company said in a statement to the Boston Globe on that it was thrilled to see the special historic moment David Ortiz captured with his Galaxy Note 3. When we heard about the visit to the White House, we worked with David and the team on how to share images with fans. We didn't know if or what he would be able to capture using his Note 3 device. That's kind of a silly statement made by Samsung, throwing out that he's using his Galaxy Note 3 device to take pictures and to share with people. I mean, now that makes it look like something was planned, something was ployed, that they wanted to use the president, the White House, you know, something secretive even, to show out to the followers, to show out to Twitter followers, to show out to people who like Samsung or just anybody out there in the world. And so now this looks not only Samsung, but David Ortiz, maybe even the Red Sox. I mean, I'm sure he didn't think about it as a marketing ploy. I mean, if you're David Ortiz, you're just won the World Series last year, and you got a ring, you're going to the White House. President Barack Obama is holding up a Red Sox jersey that has the number 44 on it, his last name Obama. I mean, you're up there giving a speech. You definitely want to take a picture. Now it's a selfie. It's posted on Twitter. It gets retweeted. Who knows if it was an intentional use of Samsung to make it a marketing kind of plan or ploy. But, I mean, it happened. And now that these statements by Samsung are out, I mean, it kind of looks like it was a marketing ploy. The seemingly unscripted moment turned promotional opportunity isn't the first time Samsung has used celebrity selfies to market its products. Last month, Ellen DeGeneres made Twitter history at the Academy Awards with her celebrity-packed group selfie, generating a record 2.7 million retweets with the picture she took using a Samsung phone. Now, I mean, you know, related or not, it's, you know, it's whatever. Samsung, it's a big company, a lot of phones, a lot of people love their phones, blah, blah, blah. The thing that's troubling about this is I think the Samsung statements are kind of a wrong thing and a wrong thing to say in that, I mean, it's like, why say that when you're being under, I mean, not an investigation, but the White House is coming after you thinking that this was a marketing ploy and that you're using the president to sell your product. That's the last thing that you want to say, is that Ortiz is using his Galaxy Note 3, the Samsung Galaxy Note 3, to take pictures, show followers. It's not the right statement. And in other news, lawmakers have agreed to military-based security and how it must be reviewed. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle agreed Sunday that everything from security procedures to budget cuts must be reviewed in light of last week's shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, which left 4 dead and 16 more wounded. Now, House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Michael McCaul said he'd like to have more military police on bases, but doesn't see how that's possible with budget cuts like sequestration. I think the best way to do it would to have more military police on our bases. But the fact is, the president's budget takes us back to World War II levels, so I don't see an increase in that kind of funding, McCaul said. I completely agree with what McCaul has said here. An increase in military police on the bases would be great. However, the president's budget takes us back to World War II levels, like I discussed earlier in my show weeks ago, how it's reducing the military size to what it was in World War II. I mean, that's so much smaller than what we need now, than what we execute now. So, I mean, it's kind of a bummer to see that we can't help out our own bases in America when we're just so stretched out all over the world. The assailant in last week's Fort Hood shooting, Army soldier Ivan Lopez, legally purchased his soon-to-be deadly weapon off base but illegally brought it into the base without registering it. Last month in Virginia, a civilian contractor killed one sailor before security personnel shot and killed him on board the USS Mahan, which was docked at a naval station, Norfolk. And in September, another civilian contractor killed 12 people and wounded 4 others at Washington's Navy Yard after going through a checkpoint and walking into the facility with a disassembled shotgun in his backpack. Another area mentioned was mental health screening, Both lawmakers pointed out that 13 years of war have put an incredible strain on the military, and many service members are coming home suffering from mental illness. McCall said he's sponsoring a bill to increase mental health screening for military personnel. Now, I agree with McCall here. I agree with those out there that are supporting mental health screening. It's nothing against the soldiers that, you know, protect our country, protect other countries, but, I mean, it's nothing new. It's no surprise that these soldiers come back from terrible war, from terrible battle, from all these experiences, and they end up having, you know, a shocking blow to the head, like, you know, the things they see we could never even imagine. Movies, army movies, action movies could never suffice to what they see in real life with their own eyes. I mean, it's scary to see that, then come back. It definitely contributes to mental health issues, and I think that mental health screening is a good way to help them out and, you know, get them the help that they need when they come home from battle, from being deployed around the world. And I also agree with the fact that we should have more military police surrounding bases to help the issue of killings and injuries that are going around the base. Now, of course, Obama is going to attend the Fort Hood Memorial Service after this terrible attack happened, leaving 4 dead and 16 wounded. And now with that, we're actually going to take a quick short break here on radio.dominican.edu. I actually still have a couple more stories for some national politics that I want to discuss and share with you guys, and then we'll go from there straight into California state politics news, and then we will wrap up the show. So please stay tuned here on radio.dominican.edu. You're listening to Penguin Radio with your host, DJ Liberty. The truth and reality, it's your liberty. Stay tuned on Political Row. Thank you.
May your hands always be busy. May your feet always be swift. May you have a strong foundation when the winds of change shift. May your heart always be joyful, may your song always be sung, and may you stay. Forever. Thank you.
What's up, everybody? This is DJ Liberty back here on my show, Political Row, on the one and only Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. So we'll jump right back into it with our national political news. We'll finish this off and then get into some California political news. Now, Jeb Bush is going to decide on his presidential run this year. Jeb Bush says he's all the speculation about whether he'll run for president in 2016 and whether it is actually getting him more attention than if he had already entered the race. The former Republican governor of Florida said that that's not by design and that he'll make his decision before the year's end. Bush says one factor in his decision will be whether he can deliver an optimistic message without getting drawn into a political mud fight. Bush has antagonized many Republicans by supporting an immigration overhaul and educational standards for kindergarten through 12th grade, known as Common Core. He says the other main factor in his decision will be whether it's okay with his family if he ran. So, on that note, we will jump over to Ted Kennedy Jr. and his decision to run for Connecticut State Senate. Ted Kennedy Jr. is planning to run for the state senate in Connecticut in his first bid for public office. Two people briefed on the decision told the Associated Press on Monday. The son of the late U.S. Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts will announce Tuesday he intends to seek the Democratic nomination for the 12th senatorial district, two people said, on condition of on his behalf because Kennedy wants to make the announcement. Kennedy said he would announce his decision that evening at a library in Brantford. Kennedy is 52 years old is a 52-year-old healthcare lawyer who lives in Brantford, a coastal town near New Haven, and has been mentioned as a possible political candidate for some time. He said last month he was considering running for the seat. As a member of one of America's most prominent political families, Kennedy Jr. has been floated over the years as a possible candidate for various political offices, including U.S. Senate seats in Connecticut and Massachusetts, but he has declined to run. He has campaigned on behalf of Democratic politicians from the state, including U.S. Senators Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal, and for President Barack Obama. His brother, former U.S. Representative Patrick Kennedy, represented Rhode Island for 16 years before retiring in 2011. Patrick Kennedy would not comment when asked to confirm whether his older brother planned to run, saying it was up to him to announce, but he said they had discussed it. The former congressman said he admired his brother for putting his family first for many years. Now, Ted Kennedy Jr.'s children are teenagers. Patrick Kennedy said his brother's life was transformed when, as a boy, he lost his leg to cancer, describing him with the phrase that was the title of a book by their uncle and former President John F. Kennedy. Patrick Kennedy said his brother became a profile in courage, surviving a deadly cancer, having his leg amputated, and later becoming a champion for people with disabilities. Now, Ted Kennedy Jr., obviously being a part of the John F. Kennedy family, definitely, I mean, with that last name, you're obviously thrown into the mix with political affiliation, the idea that you are going to take public office at some time, the fact that his brother has taken office, his father was in office, I mean, John F. Kennedy was the president of our great nation, and the fact that he's been putting it off so long now because of his family, you know, because of the ties that he's had. And I mean, his brother said it, now that his kids are teenagers, you know, maybe they can handle it a little bit better. You know, this is his time to run for something. And he's deciding now to run for Connecticut State Senate. So good for Ted Kennedy Jr. finally, you know, getting up, making the decision to go out there, put himself out there in public office and represent his family. And also and some news for the senatorial bids. Scott Brown will be kicking off his New Hampshire Senate campaign. Former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, who has been mulling a state Senate run in New Hampshire for the past few months, plans formally to announce his campaign on Thursday, the Republican said in a letter to supporters on Monday. National Republican supporters have moved quickly to buy ads supporting Brown's potential run against incumbent Democrat Jean Shaheen, seeing the race as an opportunity to shrink Democrats' 55-43 majority in the upper chamber. Brown, who has focused much of his recent public statements on his opposition to President Barack Obama's health care reform law, said in an email to supporters that his weeks of canvassing the state convinced him that you want a health care system that works for New Hampshire. Together we can do all this, but it starts by changing leadership in Washington, said Brown, who was a little known Massachusetts state senator before he stunned the state's Democratic Party to win the U.S. Senate seat previously held by Edward M. Kennedy in 2010. Now, polls show that Shaheen has a lead in the race, though her campaign was quick to jump on Brown as a possible threat and has been citing him in fundraising solicitations since before Brown last month confirmed he had formed a committee to explore a run. Brown's tenure in the Senate was short-lived, as Democrat Elizabeth Warren defeated him in 2012 in his re-election campaign. Brown, who was born in New Hampshire and moved his residence there late last year, said he would kick off his campaign in the coastal city of Portsmouth, in the state's south. So good for Scott Brown, taking some punches, losing in a race, and getting right back at it. And now we will move on to the great state of California and its political news for this week's show on Political Row. Now, California immigration holds drop significantly under Trust Act. Far fewer immigrants arrested by California law enforcement are being turned over to federal authorities for deportation since a new law went into effect in January. The law was pushed by immigrant advocates and directs law enforcement agencies to more quickly release those without serious criminal records rather than hold them so federal officials can take them into custody for deportation proceedings. Already, according to a review by the Associated Press, the new law appears to be having a big impact in slowing deportations at a time when President Barack Obama is looking to ease immigration enforcement policies nationwide and appease immigration advocates who say his administration has been too tough. Until now, California has accounted for a third of deportations under U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Secure Committees program, which screens the fingerprints of arrestees for potential immigration violations. While it was expected the state law known as the Trust Act would reduce the number of people held for possible deportation, it wasn't clear how significant the drop would be. Since sheriff's departments are responsible for most bookings, the AP surveyed those agencies in 23 counties responsible for most of California's deportations under the program. Not all supplied data for the first 2 months of this year, but among the 15 that did, there was a 44% drop from 2,984 people to only 1,660. Those 15 counties included four of the five largest in the state: Los Angeles, San Diego, Riverside, and San Bernardino. Orange County could not provide 2013 data because officials do not keep paperwork on the issue for more than a year. While most counties appear to be complying with the law, some sheriff's departments do not appear to have adopted policies to put it into action when the year began. Angela Chan, senior staff attorney at San Francisco-based civil rights organization Asian Americans Advancing Justice, said advocates have received reports of about a dozen instances where people should have been released under the new law but weren't. There is inconsistency, and that is something we're working on, she said. This is a law they have to follow. Secure Communities has led to more than 300,000 deportations since October 2008. The program has immigration agents screen the fingerprints of arrests and ask local law enforcement to hold for 48 hours those they want to deport until they can pick them up and take them to a detention facility. Now, under the Trust Act, immigrants facing trial on serious criminal charges or with serious criminal records can be held on immigration grounds, but those charged with lesser crimes are released on bail or after serving time, just like Americans. The law specifies which crimes are considered serious so that whenever someone is arrested, the treatment is supposed to be largely the same, though some counties may choose not to honor immigration holds, such as Santa Clara. In passing the legislation, California joined Connecticut and more than a dozen jurisdictions, including Cook County and Newark, New Jersey, in declining requests for immigration holds. State lawmakers in Massachusetts are considering similar legislation. The AP survey showed county-by-county disparities in the year-to-year percentage reduction of people held from 3% in San Luis Obispo to 93% in San Francisco, which last year passed a local law that restricts the use of immigration holds even further. Los Angeles, which handled the most cases, fell from 1,143 last year to 818 in the first 2 months of 2014, a 28% decline. San Diego was second in overall cases handled, but dropped 58% from 426 to 180. Immigration law experts said it's too soon to pinpoint a reason for the variation. Potential factors include a delay in some counties implementing the law and different arrest priorities and practices among the agencies, immigration experts said. And now, the federal grand jury indicts Leland Yee and 28 others, marking the next step in a sweeping FBI operation that has implicated the state senator Leland Yee. A federal grand jury indicted Yee and 28 others on Friday. The indictment charges Yee, the Democrat from San Francisco, with six counts of corruption as well as conspiracy to deal in and import firearms. If convicted on all accounts, Yee faces a sentence of up to 125 years in federal prison and $1.75 million in potential fines. Also indicted were Keith Jackson, a former San Francisco school board member, and Yee fundraiser charged with the wire fraud, gun trafficking, narcotics conspiracy, murder for hire, and conspiracy to deal in and import firearms. And in addition, the indictment and charges Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow, a convicted felon who had publicly claimed that this criminal lifestyle was in the past, with counts of money laundering, conspiracy to traffic contraband cigarettes, and conspiracy to transport and receive stolen property in interstate commerce. Friday's 50-count indictment came a little more than a week after authorities made public a 137-page criminal complaint in the case following a 5-year investigation. Also Friday, the government moved to revoke Jackson's bail, calling the former Yee consultant a flight risk and a danger to the community. Yee has been out on bail since his March 26th arrest. A judge ordered Jackson's release Thursday after he arranged $250,000 bail, secured in part by a mobile home in Texas. Prosecutors, though, said Jackson poses major risks and his bail is inadequate. And now we will shift over to some local news from my hometown, Long Beach, as there are a lot of eyes on the mayor race in Long Beach. A field of candidates, many political heavyweights and city insiders, are locked in an expensive battle to become Long Beach's newest mayor, a job that comes with expectations of reviving both the port city's economy and reputation. The April 8 election, which I voted in as an absentee ballot, has candidates vying for city attorney and a majority of Long Beach's 9 council seats, setting the stage for one of the most significant shakeups in city politics in more than a decade. But all eyes are on the mayor's race, and with the crowded field, a June runoff is likely. After Mayor Bob Forster announced last year that he would not seek a third term, the race was thrown wide open, attracting a lineup of plugged-in contenders such as Assemblywoman Bonnie Lowenthal, Council Members Robert Garcia and Jerry Shipsky, former NFL player and real estate investor Damon Dunn, and Long Beach City College trustee Doug Otto. But while Los Angeles County's second largest city is confronting rising pension costs and a listless economy, the frontrunners have focused largely on the bread and butter issues of jobs, restoring city services, and attracting business. And I know living in Long Beach all my life, that has always been the big deal. And, you know, hopefully we get a mayor that can handle that stuff sufficiently and the correct way. Most of the hopefuls were skeptical of one of the city's most ambitious projects, a $200 million plus downtown civic center, and several criticized council leaders for seeking to select a developer before the new council and mayor are even sworn in. Although Dunn and Garcia have indicated they are open to exploring options replacing the old civic center, which one city report deemed seismically unsound in a major earthquake, neither took bold stances on the costly project, which could require public-private financing and would change the face of downtown. So this is going to be a close race. All eyes are on the mayor race in Long Beach. It's going to be a big deal. We'll see what happens. April 8th is the election. My absentee ballot has sent in, and hopefully the right person wins, right man or woman. So that is going to do it for me, DJ Liberty, on my show tonight, Political Row, on the one and only radio.dominican.edu. I want to thank everybody out there. I want to thank the soccer players here at Dominican, Corey Vanderpool, Eric Anderson, Lee LeVerrier, Mark Caligari, you know, the entire team, whatever. I love you guys, and I also want to thank my family, my friends back home for listening, and all you followers. So thank you so much, and tune in next week, Monday, from 7 to 8 p.m. on Political Row. The truth and reality, it's your liberty, only here on Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. Thank you, everybody.